This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry that allows you to control and manage your own healthcare and choose any doctor or hospital in the nation. If you're a freedom-loving American looking for contract-free healthcare, call now 855-585-4237 or go to libertyhealthshare.org.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thanks so much for joining us again. Well, President Trump recently announced in a speech an expansion of U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan. And for some Marines, this harkens back to a horrible event that changed their lives on March 4th, 2007. That was the day that Fox Company, the first Marine Special Operations Unit to enter combat in Afghanistan, was ambushed by a car bomber, setting off a terrible chain of events that remains with them even today. A media storm accused the Marines of possible war crimes amid false accusations of negligent homicide against Afghan civilians. The Marines ended up being expelled from Afghanistan and sent back to the United States. And this was followed by a rare weeks-long hearing and an eventual clearing of the Marines of any wrongdoing. In fact, they were proven to have made sound decisions during that initial ambush. But to this day, these Marines have not been fully exonerated in the public eye. And this is the purpose of a House resolution introduced earlier this year that would require the Marines' top general to issue a public document certifying that members of Fox Company were not at fault in the firefight and deserve to have their names cleared. Well, joining me today is retired Marine Major Fred Galvin. He was the commanding officer of Fox Company, also called Task Force Violent. We're going to hear more from him about what these Marines went through and also hear some of his thoughts about President Trump's plans for Afghanistan. Major Galvin, it's really an honor to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Janet. Appreciate being here. Yes.
Absolutely. I have read through your story, many, many, many pages of what happened. I know a lot of people will remember what happened to your company. You were ambushed, and yet you were expelled from Afghanistan. As I said, went through this hearing. You were cleared of any wrongdoing, but still the lies remain in the public eye. Tell people, if you would, a little bit about what really happened.
Well, as you'd mentioned, we were the very first company that the Marine Corps was ordered by Dr. Rumsfeld, who was the Secretary of Defense, to stand up a tactical unit of Marine Special Operations forces. And we deployed it at that time in 2007. We did not know the location. We actually found out when we were on ship. And we ended up in eastern Afghanistan, right at the base of the Tor Bora Mountains and right along the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. So this is, as you know, a very volatile, politically sensitive area. This is where, right along the border where we were at, like right on the border, is the sanctuary there with Pakistan, where all these foreign fighters receive, in many cases, their last final stages of training. They get radicalized. A lot of them would be fully trained as suicide bombers, and then they would come across this border checkpoint right where we were, into this first town. It was a small village named Body Cove. And we were placed in that area to conduct reconnaissance and begin to develop an intelligence picture. And we really did have a good idea of what was going on in that area. And on the morning of the 4th of March, we were going in there with these ridiculous rules of engagement, which had changed from the U.S. rules of engagement. And then just prior to us arriving there, in 2006, they changed into the NATO rules of engagement. So where we had been doing combat operations in Iraq, where we knew there was enemy, there was no doubt that these guys were bad guys, we could go take action here, you basically had to merely build a federal case to go do anything. So instead of going in there and acting on the overwhelming amount of information and proven intelligence that we had to go meet the tribal elders. My philosophy was not to drink tea and go overboard, but we had to do this procedure. And as we were driving into this town, we were hit with a car bomb. It was a van completely filled with explosives, shrapnel, and it was filled with fuel. It was the largest explosion that I'd seen in my life, up to 4 combat deployments at that time. So it really destroyed the road underneath it, and it detonated 5 feet in front of our second vehicle, wounding the individual that was in the turret manning the machine gun. So at that time, we knew that, okay, this town is definitely not friendly. Then we started receiving fire from individuals that were in a Toyota Prado, a sports utility vehicle that was to our left. Four individuals were driving towards us, aiming that vehicle straight at the vehicle in our convoy that had been blown up, trying to finish it off. So our Marines quickly oriented on that threat and engaged them. Three individuals fired at them with machine guns aiming in at the windshield. That picture has been sensationalized in the New York Times and many other mainstream medias. You know, look at how many gunshots went into this windshield of this vehicle. So that all that news, I'm going to get to that in a second, that all went out immediately. But
right.
So back to the action, we're still in the gunfight. We continue to receive fire from our left, and then it came from our right. We engaged and destroyed those enemies. And there was radio exchange between the other officer and myself in the convoy that we were there in the ambush state. We decided, okay, we needed to get an assessment of where our men were. This was 9 a.m. in the morning. And then we decided, we knew that there was four suicide bombers in that small village. It was a crowded market bazaar, so we decided we're going to abort the mission. There's three other active suicide bombers in this area. Just got shot at on both sides of the road. So after 5 minutes, and in that time, and we lost communication with one vehicle. It was visually right in front of us, but its radios were damaged. So once we got accountability of all our men equipment, we, after a five-minute period, we left the kill zone and returned, heading back to our small base, where we still continued to receive fire from our right side of the road, to include sniper fire from a mountain. And that all came out in the courtroom, that our vehicles were hit with Soviet Dragunov sniper rifle rounds. And then by the time we arrived back to the base, Janet, 20 minutes later, we had already been greeted at the gate by our operations staff from our Marine Special Operations Company, telling me, sir, this is already on, you know, BBC. So within 20 minutes of being attacked to the international press, this is already out there saying that we killed women and children. And the numbers just grew and grew from 8 to 10 to 12, all the way up to, you know, the battle space commander and Army colonel at that time, who's over there in Afghanistan right now, is the four-star U.S.-American general in charge of all forces. He said his estimate, which he paid a salacious payments equivalent of 4 years' salary. That's basically like giving an American salary of $52,000 times four to anybody that would not provide any evidence, but just give doling out American taxpayers' dollars. He paid 19 Afghan civilians that he said were killed, and another 50 that he said were wounded. And unprecedented, he went to the international press himself with a former peer of his, Lieutenant General Frank Kearney. So both then Colonel John Nicholson and Lieutenant General Frank Kearney, in unprecedented, during a criminal investigation, they went to the Washington Post, Reuters, several other news sources repeatedly during an ongoing criminal investigation, and condemned us before and after we even had returned back to America. So we'd been told, hey, you're going to get expelled. We were kicked out before the preliminary investigation was even done. Then we head back to America, and the first day we land, you know, page 81 of the Washington Post has, you know, Congressman Adam Smith from Washington State condemning us, saying at a minimum this is excessive force. So as your leaders are digesting this, they're probably like, this really happened. And
it's just incredible. It's really hard to understand how it is that this happened 10 years ago, and yet you and your Marines have not been fully exonerated, even though you have been determined to have been fully justified in how you behaved and what you did there on the battlefield in Afghanistan. It's just an incredible story. There's more to come, by the way, and we're going to come back after this break on Janet Mefford Today with Major Fred Galvin, the 1st Marine Special Operations Unit Commander, to enter combat in Afghanistan. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Here is today's Capitol Hill Brief with Concerned Women for America President Penny Nance.
What does Planned Parenthood actually do? Mammograms? Nope. What about prenatal care? Actually, only 8% of their clinics do that. They boast about gynecological exams and STD testing, but those are available through the more than 11,000 community health centers in America. In fact, Planned Parenthood only does about 1% of the nation's pap smears and only about 2% of breast exams. Yet, they perform a full third of the nation's abortions. Abortion accounts for 86% of their non-governmental revenue. 94 out of 100 of their pregnant patients get one. It's time to stop funding them with our tax dollars.
Join us on the front lines. Fight to defend critical issues like the sanctity of life through prayer and action. Together, we'll bring biblical constitutional values back to our nation. Visit CapitolHillBrief.org to give today. That's CapitolHillBrief.org. Everyone loves liberty. Our rights come from God, not from government. So why are you letting other people tell you what's best for your health care? Exercise your freedom with Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of people who voluntarily share one another's medical costs. Liberty HealthShare is founded on the idea that most people truly want to help one another. Healthcare sharing allows members to do just that as a true community that supports one another in times of need. Liberty believes people should make decisions for themselves and their families. Members are able to take back the freedom to make their own decisions about their health care. Freedom from guilt or doubt about how your money is used. You have the freedom to direct your health care, not to be dictated to by bureaucrats. Stop letting others tell you what to do and join a community of like-minded people. Exercise your freedom. Join Liberty HealthShare and take back the control of your health care while helping those around you. Call us at 855-58-LIBERTY for more information or check us out online at libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org. We are back on Janet Mefford today, and with us is Major Fred Galvin. He was the commander of the 1st Marine Special Operations Unit to enter combat in Afghanistan, the head of Fox Company, which was ambushed by a car bomber, and it set off a terrible chain of events. A media storm accused them of possible war crimes with these false accusations of killing Afghan civilians. They ended up being expelled from Afghanistan and sent back home. They finally had a hearing. They were eventually cleared, but to this day, they haven't been fully exonerated in the public eye. That's what they're seeking, and that is the purpose of a House resolution that would clear it all up and fully exonerate them. Major Galvin, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is you had said that it was about 20 minutes between the time that the car bomb went off and the time you got back to your base. And yet BBC was already reporting on it within just a few minutes. Who was giving the media this info, and why was that occurring without the Marines fully understanding your side of the story?
This tactic, which has been practiced at that stage in the game, we were kind of like a proof of concept for the Taliban, who had begun, you know, evolving this and making their tactics a little bit more sophisticated. So their little dual-prong technique is if they win the ambush, it's a success. They've killed Americans or coalition members. And if they lose, they already have a teed-up story ready to go that's, you know, immediately broadcast to multiple members of the international media, which happened in our case. And then when here's a Marine Special Operation, the entire company, the first time in history, gets kicked out. Well, that emboldened, you know, the Taliban. So this technique became further used and still is to this day of, you know, the terrorists like to, you know, use bombs, kill civilians, and now they are just saying that we are doing it to erode the trust not only of the local populace, but of American and the, you know, international community, that how can these Americans be doing this? This is terrible. Later on, they used to, ours, they didn't have a single bullet, a drop of blood, a body, a photo of a body. And this is 2007, Janet. So later on, they started to add in other allegations with other, you know, U.S. military units that, oh, these people under the blankets are dead. And then they actually started killing themselves, which we had drone footage of Taliban just killing women and children to say that Americans had done it. So this continued to evolve and progress. And our U.S. senior leaders fell for this. I remember in 2003 in Iraq, I was pulled in by my commanding officer. I was a young force recon platoon commander, and he had said that he spoke with the tribal elders. This is the beginning of the Iraq War, and he said, I have no trust and confidence in this Marine Infantry Company commander because they just killed these civilians. And, you know, I found out immediately from talking myself to that Marine captain that that didn't happen at all. So our senior leaders in the U.S. military are very keen to throw our own troops under the bus and accept wholeheartedly at face value the testimony of, you know, the tribal leaders in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And this is continuing on to be the case right now, where we see our senior leaders prostrating themselves to protect the population, just as General John Nicholson did after we were in this ambush, and is continuing to this day over in Afghanistan right now.
Unbelievable. So you were exonerated, but it never really took root in the public understanding the way that the initial allegations did. And so this has been, I know, very frustrating for you and for your men. You have suffered greatly over these many years, 10 years since this actually occurred. You've said that was by design, that the exoneration has never received the same amount of media coverage as the false allegations. How was that by design, do you think?
Well, as a specific example, we were tried for 3.5 weeks. This, at that time, was the longest courtroom trial in Marine Corps history because it was the largest war crime of alleged 19 deaths and 50 wounded. So that ended on the 29th of January, 2008. 4 months later, on Memorial Day weekend of 2008, the convening authority released a one-sentence statement saying that the Marines acted appropriately. And in every other military justice case, it's going to end in either guilty, not guilty, or dismissed. And there is also a precedent that same year, General Mattis was the convening authority in our case and in the case for the Marines in Haditha. They had a preliminary investigation, and he stated that, in my eyes and in the eyes of the law, you are innocent. And that's what we seek, some actual closure. So the seven of us, if you look at what has happened, one Marine had very severe cancer, another Marine had diabetes, you know, another Marine had his family threatened during the investigation phase to be deported unless he went along, and he did sign a pre-made statement by NCS. So what was used to coerce our Marines, and what is currently, you know, here a retired, forced to retire, moved back to Kansas, have applied for over 400 jobs, and when you are blackballed, it's hopeless to try to get any type of legitimate work that has, you know, a future. And that's where our Marines right now, the seven of us, are sitting. And that's why this House Resolution 21 is so important. It sat in committee for 8 months. And we are hoping that your listeners not just listen, but they take action. It costs no money to call your congressional representatives and urge them to vote yay on House Resolution 21.
Absolutely. I know the fact that it was introduced, what, back in February, and there hasn't been passage movement on this. I mean, there absolutely needs to be movement on this. What has held it up, do you think?
Well, in comparison, it's interesting. Both this House resolution, I'm not fully cognizant of why the naming conventions are what they are, but there's two House Resolution 21. One's H period, R period 21, and that was merely to limit the power of the President of the United States. And that was initiated just like R, H period, RES period 21. Both were initiated on the 3rd of January, 2017. And in January 4th, 2017, the day after H period, R period, to limit the power of the President of the United States after a President-elect has been voted on, that passed 238 to 184 unanimously. And that's moved on to the Senate. But ours is sat in committee. Who knows? But the Marine Corps obviously will not correct the record. And all it takes is saying that, you know, we are innocent. We are not to blame in this firefight. That's what we're asking.
Yeah. Well, rightly so. And I think all the listeners should contact their congressmen and let their voices be heard, because there's no reason, there's no excuse for what happened to you guys. And if you guys go to the Military Times 5-part series, it explains everything in greater detail than we're allowed to do right now because of time. Now, I'm curious to turn to your thoughts, Major Galvin, on Trump's speech about Afghanistan, because one of the things is many of the leaders that are still in place are the ones that were there when you were there. What are your thoughts on the new strategy or the new need for military strategy in Afghanistan?
Well, I have not heard of a new strategy. I've heard of people bumbling something around, but the gentleman who did kick us out, he is now in charge of all forces in Afghanistan. When you look at his track record, I'm just going to quickly cover four important facts. His first tour, which was when we were there, his first combat deployment into Afghanistan was when he was a colonel, uninitiated until 2006, but he had 45 of his soldiers killed and another 350 wounded, which was the highest casualty rate of any unit in Afghanistan. His second tour, when he was a general, he went there in 2008 and 2009, the U.S. casualty rate increased during that time period 104%. Mm. His third tour, in 2012, U.S. fatalities killed by insiders, those that we were training, the Afghan soldiers that, you know, said that they're going to serve to fight for their country, they killed us. That increase went up 408%. And now during his current tour, which he's trying to increase the security and stability of the Afghan country, the Afghan civilian deaths are up 24% on his watch so far from 2016 up. You know, these are facts. 3,498 Afghan civilians killed, wounded 7,920. He's in charge right now. I don't hear any of anything regarding how the strategy has changed, but I know he's still in charge. This is the man that took to the press condemning us, which is out there on the internet. You can Google search Colonel John Nicholson and listen to how he, during an ongoing criminal investigation, took to the press and condemned us of murder and has never taken the action to correct it. As a matter of fact, he published a little article, or there's a part on page 114 to 117 in Carlotta Gall, New York Times reporter's book, The Wrong Enemy, where he, in 2012, after the Court of Inquiry proved that we were innocent, he further condemned us. So this unrepentant general, he's not going to change his way. That's proven. And when he leaves sometime this year, we will see that, you know, he's a failed general and there is no policy to send more U.S. forces there. We have to have leaders that have not done what we've done in the last 16 years, which is very little. The generals who have been there, whether it's General Allen or General Petraeus, they've been known to have affairs, and they didn't care. They were there to get famous and have a book written about them and be sending emails back and forth. They just don't care. General Nicholson, he brought his wife over there, and he brought her to this Shura, that where he again apologized for the Afghan civilian deaths. This is not a story. These are facts.
Well, the important thing for everybody to understand is how vital it is for us to stand up and go to our congressmen and to urge them to put through this resolution that would finally clear you and clear your men. I know it's been a very difficult experience, not just for you, Major Galvin, but for all the men who have been over there. You've detailed in some of what you've written and what you've put out online all of the hardships that have happened to these men. And it's just not right. We're in the United States of America. We are proud of our military. We are proud of your heroic action over in Afghanistan. You got a raw deal and you were really treated unfairly. It is not right. It's why we're here telling the story. So you can contact your congressman and urge them to pass H-Res 21. Major Fred Galvin, what an honor to talk to you. What a hero, sir. Thank you. We'll be right back on Janet Meffer Today. This Janet Meffer Today podcast is sponsored by Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry that allows you to control and manage your own healthcare and choose any doctor or hospital in the nation. If you're a freedom-loving American looking for contract-free healthcare, call now 855-585-4237 or go to libertyhealthshare.org. and Janet Meffer today. Thanks for being with us. All right. Well, President Trump has made his move on DACA. I thought this was kind of funny. I saw this story from Christianity Today. A few days ago, they were announcing all these evangelical leaders who are up in arms about DACA. They're so upset about DACA, you can't get rid of the dreamers because they're our future church leaders. And they are blessed and they're wonderful and they're fantastic. And I'm thinking, when did evangelicals become the group of people in the country who decided that the rule of law doesn't matter and neither does the Constitution? I know that there are a lot of people who have come here who didn't have a say in it, whose mom and dad came here illegally, and they are not familiar with the country from which their parents came. They are Americans. They're here. But on the other hand, it's unconstitutional. I don't know how you get around that. President Obama said on 22 separate occasions that he could not grant de facto amnesty to groups of people. And then he went ahead and did it when he couldn't get his progressive version of comprehensive immigration reform. That's the history on all of this. And if we're going to be a sovereign nation with borders and with the rule of law, then at some point you just have to say actions have consequences, unfortunately. And a lot of people who are brought here, who I'm sure are very decent, hardworking people, are going to have to go. That's just the way it is. If you're here illegally, you're going to have to go back. And everybody thinks this is so heartless, and yet we never seem to really get to the fundamental question, not only of the rule of law and the Constitution, but whether or not Americans matter, or if Americans matter more in America. It's just so twisted. They've got us in some kind of knot here across this country with progressive rhetoric and narratives being pushed from sea to shining sea by the media all the time. Oh, these poor people, we need to be compassionate. We need to be compassionate. It's not the job of the government, by the way, to extend mercy. It's not that you cannot extend mercy and temper your decisions with mercy. But fundamentally, why has God appointed government? It is to have the power of the sword, keep the order, punish evildoers. This is the job of the state. We seem to forget that. We have these categories that Christians have long understood as these different structures and foundational institutions that God created, the family and the government and, you know, the church. And so we used to understand how those things were separate from one another. Nowadays, it's just, no, we got to get DACA back. This is terrible. Our blessed church leaders will be deported. It's fallen flat with me, especially when you have groups like the Evangelical Immigration Table and World Relief, which is all about millions in federal money to resettle refugees. And I mean, this is just the progressive wing. Soros funds the Evangelical Immigration Table. How many evangelicals even know that? Do you really want to go along with the Soros agenda? And it's all done in the name of evangelicalism, and it's really hard to take. So let's jump over to what Attorney General Jeff Sessions had to say yesterday regarding the rescinding of DACA. This is Cut One.
I'm here today to announce that the program known as DACA that was effectuated under the Obama administration is being rescinded. The DACA program was implemented in 2012 and essentially provided a legal status for recipients for a renewable two-year term, worker authorization, and other benefits, including participation in the Social Security program, to 800,000 mostly adult illegal aliens. The policy was implemented unilaterally to great controversy and legal concern after Congress rejected legislative proposals to extend similar benefits on numerous occasions to this same group of illegal aliens. In other words, the executive branch, through DACA, deliberately sought to achieve what the legislative branch specifically refused to authorize on multiple occasions. Such an open-ended circumvention of immigration laws was an unconstitutional exercise of authority by the executive branch.
That's important. What he just said is important because, as you know, we have a balance of powers in this country. The founders were geniuses. They understood that you had to have checks and balances, and they're supposed to work well. And if Congress says we're not going to pass comprehensive immigration reform to the liking of progressives, then you just have to live with it if you're the president. That's how it goes. And you don't go around the law and put out an executive order circumventing immigration law and doing what you yourself have admitted before is unconstitutional. And that's what happened. Nobody wants to talk about that on the left. They just want to talk about dreamers, dreamers. I'm getting so tired of that. I'm not trying to disparage, by the way, anybody who's been brought here by parents illegally. It's not the fault of those kids. It's, I mean, we're mostly adults. Let's make sure we stress that, mostly adults. But I'm concerned about Americans, first and foremost, because this is America. And that's how it has to be. I am concerned about those hardworking immigrants who came to this country legally and waited in line and did everything under the rule of law to become citizens of this great nation. There are millions and millions of them. And I know how frustrated some of them are that under Obama, people got to cut in line illegally. And that really bugs a lot of recent immigrants who did it the right way. And we should not apologize at all for saying it's got to be done the right way. Let's go on. Jeff Sessions continues. This is Cut 2.
The effect of this unilateral executive amnesty, among other things, contributed to a surge of minors at the southern border that yielded terrible humanitarian consequences. It also denied jobs to hundreds of thousands of Americans by allowing those same illegal aliens to take those jobs. We inherited from our founders and have advanced an unsurpassed legal heritage, which is the foundation of our freedom, our safety, and our prosperity. As Attorney General, it is my duty to ensure that the laws of the United States are enforced and that the constitutional order is upheld. No greater good for the overall health and well-being of our republic than preserving and strengthening the impartial rule of law.
That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about, is the rule of law. Let's continue on. This is Cut 3.
Societies where the rule of law is treasured are societies that tend to flourish and succeed. Societies where the rule of law is subject to political whims and personal biases tend to become societies afflicted by corruption, poverty, and human suffering. To have a lawful system of immigration that serves the national interest, we cannot admit everyone who would like to come here. It's just that simple. That would be an open borders policy, and the American people have rightly rejected that. Therefore, the nation must set and enforce a limit on how many immigrants we admit each year, and that means all cannot be accepted. This does not mean they are bad people or that our nation disrespects or demeans them in any way. It means we are properly enforcing our laws as Congress has passed them.
Exactly right. Back to the power of Congress. This is a matter for Congress to pass a law, whether or not it's a law I like, it's the way it's supposed to happen. So that's what needs to happen. So we'll see what Congress does. We'll see what their decision is about moving forward, and nothing's going to happen overnight. You know, you're not going to have mass deportation of 800,000 people. As the New York Times said, administration officials said the roughly 800,000 current beneficiaries of the program brought here illegally will not be immediately affected by what they called an orderly wind down of former President Obama's policy. And of course, President Trump put out a statement and he said, only by the reliable enforcement of immigration law can we produce safe communities, a robust middle class, and economic fairness for all Americans. He called the DACA program an amnesty first approach. Well, he had to follow through on it. He promised that he would. A couple of statistics, just to put it in context, by the way, from Daniel Horowitz over at Conservative Review. I think these statistics are worth dwelling on with a little bit more time put into it. Illegal aliens, he notes, account for 13.6% of all offenders sentenced for crimes committed in the U.S., even though they only represent 3.5% of the population. We need more crime? No. Illegals account for 12% of murder sentences, 20% of kidnapping sentences, and 16% of drug trafficking sentences. There are 2.1 million illegal and legal immigrants convicted of crimes, but 1.2 million criminal aliens remain at large in the U.S. and have not been deported. Remember, the prime demographic for violent crime is young males, broadly covered by the quote-unquote dream amnesty. What about the biblical response to this issue of illegal immigration, specifically DACA? We're going to come back and tell you more. Stay with us here on Janet Mefford Today.
Watching the news can feel so overwhelming, like everything's spinning out of control. This is Jeannie Nigro with Unshaken. News reports these days focus almost entirely on the negative. with viewers feeling fearful, unprotected, frustrated, or hopeless, like there's nothing they could possibly do to make a difference. Well, that's exactly what the enemy wants you to think. There's a spiritual battle going on every time you watch the news, as negativity, fear, anger, and hopelessness all give the enemy a handle or ground in your life. So when you watch the news, confess your negative emotions. Choose to pray about each story. Speak blessing over those you don't like. And fast to see breakthroughs in impossible situations. Then you'll be making the way for real change to occur. For more on how to remain unshaken in a world that's all shook up, or to download a free chapter of my book, Unshaken, Standing Strong in Uncertain Times, go to jeannienigro.com/Janet. That's jeannienigro.com, JeannieNigro.com/Janet.
Everyone loves liberty. Our rights come from God, not from government. So why are you letting other people tell you what's best for your health care? Exercise your freedom with Liberty Health Share. Liberty Health Share is a community of people who voluntarily share one another's medical costs. Liberty Health Share is founded on the idea that most people truly want to help one another. Healthcare sharing allows members to do just that as a true community that supports one another in times of need. Liberty believes people should make decisions for themselves and their families. Members are able to take back the freedom to make their own decisions about their health care. Freedom from guilt or doubt about how your money is used. You have the freedom to direct your health care, not to be dictated to by bureaucrats. Stop letting others tell you what to do and join a community of like-minded people. Exercise your freedom. Join Liberty Health Share and take back the control of your health care while helping those around you. Call us at 855-58-LIBERTY for more information or check us out online at libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org. We're back on Janet Mefford today. I'm a dreamer. I dream of all sorts of things. I dream of the wall. I dream of secure borders. I dream of the day when the global elites who want to open the borders to let everybody flood across, including terrorists, will come to a pitiful and driven down end. I don't know. I dream of all sorts of things, but I think this dreamer thing and the way that we're using this word in the context of illegal aliens is just another propaganda tactic. By the way, Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State in the state of Kansas, had a really good couple of clips here that I want to play for you. This was actually before the Attorney General came out and announced the rescinding of DACA, but he was explaining the legal side of this. Again, I don't think a lot of Americans spend a lot of time focusing on whether or not DACA was even allowed to have been done. He does a good job. He went on Fox. This is what he said, cut four.
DACA violates the United States Constitution in two different ways. It also violates three different federal statutes, and it's not just my opinion. You've had lower federal courts already say that. So it's illegal, and it should end now. We shouldn't say, well, we recognize that it's illegal, and we recognize it's violating our Constitution, but let's just keep on violating our Constitution for 6 months or however long. We need to end it, and we need to start looking after United States citizens first. You know, it's a really tough job market right now for U.S. citizens out there. Young people who are coming out of high school right now, unemployment is 17%. Underemployment, where they're working part-time when they would like to be working full-time, is 31%. For young college graduates, it's 12% underemployment. So it's a tough job market, and those in Congress who are saying, you know, Mr. President, don't get rid of this DACA amnesty, should remember that our young U.S. citizens are having a really tough time. Why would you want to give an amnesty to 1.7 million young illegal aliens to compete against them?
Well, because they want to have a permanent voting majority for the Democratic Party. We know the reason, but yes, this is how Americans ought to be thinking about this. The fact that it violates not only the Constitution in two different ways, but three different federal statutes. Doesn't that matter? Don't we care about the rule of law? Well, I had mentioned before Christianity Today had done a piece. They've done a couple of pieces now on these liberal evangelical groups. I don't even know if those two words can go together without being completely oxymoronic, but let's just go with it. Liberal Christian groups yelling and screaming, people associated with the Soros-funded evangelical immigration table. Oh, this is so heartless. This is so terrible. But we do have a group on the other side. We don't hear from these people quite as much because Christianity Today gives more press to the liberals. But it's a group called Evangelicals for Biblical Immigration. This is a group of faith leaders and other evangelical Christian conservatives who went to President Trump and also Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and wrote a letter
to these politicians and said the following: "We agree that immigration reform and DACA are difficult subjects. God loves the foreigner. Indeed, God loves us all. It takes time to discern the balance of mercy and justice by which a nation thrives. It's easier to speak publicly of mercy, as we and many do. And while loving mercy, who will also stand for justice for those citizens who cannot find a job due to cheaper foreign labor?" Great question. Who will speak of the real cost of illegal immigration to our states? And while many non-citizens are good neighbors, who will stand for justice for Americans victimized by people here illegally who do not uphold our values and laws? And who will prevent more needless crime and death? The church is called to serve all people, and our government leaders are elected to defend and uphold the Constitution and the rule of law. Though there are tragic stories on every side of illegal migration, for our elected officials, responsibility to oaths must prevail. Thank you. Law and order sustain stability and peace. A nation of wise rule grows strong enough to sustain care for the vulnerable in our midst. While some faith groups use selective Bible words for open borders and amnesty, we consider the whole counsel of Scripture. Excellent. We find that the Bible does not teach open borders, but wise welcome. We are to welcome the lawful foreigner who, like a convert, comes as a blessing, such as Ruth and Rahab. We also find Nehemiah building walls to protect citizens from harm. In Isaiah chapter 1, we see God condemning the destruction of borders and indigenous culture. All lives matter. The lives of North, Central, and South Americans matter. The lives of Africans, Asians, Europeans, and people from the Middle East matter. In Scripture, we learn that God placed us each in a family, a land, an epic story of creation, the fall, and redemption. The Bible envisions a world of beautiful, unique nations, not a stateless, open society run by global oligarchs. Each of us is called to be a blessing where God has placed us in the world. And in policy decisions ahead, while treating undocumented people kindly, we ask that you would, first and foremost, honor often forgotten American citizens whose families have served our nation for many generations, and the patient people who have applied lawfully to come here and to become citizens of the United States. These lives also matter. These people also dream. Well said. Well said. Now, I went back to a piece from a few years ago. I remember reading this back in 2009. Boy, that's been a while now. A Biblical Perspective on Immigration Policy. It's by James R. Edwards, Jr. He is a PhD co-author of The Congressional Politics of Immigration Reform, and he contributed a chapter related to this topic to Carol Swain's Debating Immigration. And this is a good piece. This is over at the Center for Immigration Studies. And he talks about the background, quoting from Romans 13 about letting every person be subject to the governing authorities. We know that passage. Similar teachings in 1 Peter chapter 2, Titus 3. But this is interesting and such an important point. He says, similar teachings, such as in 1 Peter and Titus, urge citizens to obey secular authorities because they hold godly agency, whether the individuals in charge are personally characterized by godliness or not. This conduct of good citizenship is one means of revering God. Earthly governors bear the sword on behalf of those under their authority. For instance, preserving law and order, fighting off invaders, and meting out punishment to those who break the law. The authority God delegates to civil government focuses on justice, not mercy. Though this is not to say laws should not be tempered by mercy, biblical teachings of mercy generally apply to individual conduct, not to civil authorities. Further, standards of justice are not fully moral if they are not accompanied by judgment and punishment. These two elements are integral, or else justice is not just. In other words, civil government has been delegated authority to use force because government fulfills the role of protector of a specific body politic and the members of that political society. The reason the sword of justice has been delegated to earthly governments is for protection of a defined set of people who live under a government's jurisdiction. It is not power for power's sake, but power to protect and defend a state's own people and resources. Earthly rulers are to guard their own citizens against evil in the world and in the hearts of men. There's your argument. There's a really great argument, and I'm glad that it was stated in the way it was stated because it makes so much sense. what is the purpose of civil government? I would love to sit down some of these Soros-funded types and say, what is the purpose of government? Is it to be merciful to people who are not citizens of this country? Or is it to serve and protect and defend the members of this society and the citizens of this country? How in the world could you ever look at that question and come up with answer A? Oh, no, we have to worry about the dreamers. No, they don't have to worry about the dreamers insofar that they mangle the Constitution and create out of thin air some sort of authority via executive action to let all these people stay and take the jobs that rightly belong to Americans. There is nothing wrong with saying that. In fact, I believe that that is the biblical position. I'm glad that the Evangelicals for Biblical Immigration have made their voice heard as well, because we need to be very, very clear on these things. We have a solid biblical argument on these issues, and it's really important. And one of the things that we've talked about before, but I think bears repeating, is whenever they talk about welcoming the stranger, it is not faithful to the text of Scripture when you look at what these words actually mean in the original languages. As they point out in this article, even the passages of Scripture most often cited by religious advocates of mass immigration and amnesty plainly do not argue for open borders. And there's a reference here to Leviticus 19 about a stranger sojourning and so forth. And the Hebrew term for sojourn means temporary stay. A related term used in some scriptural translations is stranger. One Bible dictionary says this word generally denotes a person from a foreign land residing in Palestine. Such persons enjoyed many privileges in common with the Jews, but still were separate from them. So when you hear this biblical language flung around, welcome the stranger, don't you love the stranger, don't you feel compassion? We do feel compassion for individual people, but we have to be a nation of laws. DACA never should have been rendered in the first place. How about we talk about that for a while? How about we talk about the lawlessness of the previous president that got us into this mess? And instead of yelling at Trump, why don't you get frustrated with the one who created the situation in which Trump had to reverse it? I don't think that's probably going to happen, but hope springs eternal, doesn't it? Hey, thanks a lot for being with us. We appreciate you stopping by, and we'll see you next time right here on Janet Mefford Today. God bless.